kill eye.
What is that? A plea for us not to kill it? Or a promise that it won't kill us?
I don't know, Captain. Evidently, it gained an immediate knowledge of us from its empathy with me. In my brief contact with the creature's mind, I discovered it as a highly intelligent, extremely sophisticated animal. In great pain, of course, because of its wound. But not reacting at all like a wounded creature.
Thank you for downloading another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry DeFellin, and I am joined, as always, by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
And Graham Sibley.
Hello.
Right, well, today's episode, or this episode of Whom Pods Destroy, is dedicated to just one episode of the original series, one of which we're all very, very fond of, and one that, from my experience, ranks highly in fan surveys of Star Trek episodes in general and the original series in particular, and that is The Devil in the Dark. The Devil in the Dark. Derek, you chose this.
As one of my favourites.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Why?
Well, again, it was one of the first episodes.
Wait. I better know what's coming up now.
Yes.
This is a photo novel, isn't it?
No, it isn't. This one isn't in the photo novel. I think they did. They do one? They probably
they did.
Yeah, okay. No, it's not a photo novel, but it is one of the first I remember being watching on our small black and white television.
Oh, right. Okay.
And being very engrossed in, mainly because I think of Spock. Because he has that one scene later on.
Mm.
But, he has a major part to play in this. And he really does sort of, show off the character about how different he is from his crewmates because of his special powers and things like this that he has, which is very much differentiates him from anyone else in the show.
I like the way Spock thinks as well in this episode,
yeah,
because he's the guy who first twigs. He sees the silicon nodules in Vanderbilt's office,
yeah,
and he's preoccupied with them. And McCoy makes fun of him when Spock is postulating the origins of the Horta and its makeup and why they can't find it. And I just love the way that Spock just is he's an alien,
mm-hmm,
and his brain is wired differently, and he's seeing things differently to the way that the human crew are. Let me just do a quick synopsis. Janus 6 is a mining colony. There's rich deposits there, but it's not a very well-funded or resourced mining colony, it seems. In recent times, people have been dying. They've been killed by some creature that seems to move through rock. No one seems to be able to get a good look at it, not long enough before they're dead anyway. And they die horribly, burned to a crisp. And the Enterprise is summoned to try and find and ultimately kill this creature. The creature, it turns out, is based upon silicon life. It's called Horta, and actually it's a very gentle creature, and the reason why they've started killing is because the miners have gone down a level, they've encountered her eggs, her unborn children, and they've just, without realising what they are, destroyed them and killed thousands of these creatures. And so once everybody understands what's happened, a resolution is made and a deal is done and everyone is happy. Graham, I think the thing that strikes me about an episode like this is it sets itself up as a monster episode, and in fact it's completely the opposite.
Yeah, it's exactly that. I mean, it's, you can tell from the teaser bit at the start, which is the only one without any of the members of the regular cast in it. This thing, it just happens in these tunnels, and there's the eerie music in the background, and then an unseen monster grabs the lone guard out there who knows he's going to die.
That's really eerie part of that.
Yeah.
He says, it can happen in 2 minutes. I mean, he's just standing there going, I'm dead.
Yeah.
I'm a dead man.
Yeah.
And everyone is sort of like saying, you'll be all right. And he's like, you're
You're leaving me here to die.
Yeah.
Basically. And it's another one of these Bond episodes.
Someone was recording a Bond podcast yesterday.
Yes. It's another Trek episode where life is cheap.
Mm.
Isn't it? Because 50 people have died to get to this point.
I know. It's taken, I mean, really, to be honest with you, one person dies, and then you call the starship.
Yeah.
You don't wait for 50 people to die. Then, do you know what? Maybe we should do with some help.
Yeah, maybe we should stop mining for a bit.
If this was a modern episode of Star Trek, there'd be a B-plot where they would be investigating why they'd waited so long before calling in any help, but they don't. They don't have B plots in this.
But it is a classic monster movie because you've got the monster there.
Yes,
but also it's, you know, who's the real monster here?
Who is indeed who are the real monsters? Exactly.
Which is the same with every monster.
Exactly. All monster movies are basically that, aren't they?
I mean, the interesting thing that is the actual title as well.
Yes.
Devil in the Dark. And what I felt was really nice was the bit where the Haunter calls the humans the devils.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really nice.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean there's a strong, it's an odd makeup, isn't it? Because all of these miners are kind of quite aggressive white guys who are unhappy. Their quotas are being met, and they seem to be. I was thinking that, you know, I mean, those guys could have given them, you know, make America great again hats, and they wouldn't have been out of place at all. But I mean, they're kind of, what are they more upset about? Are they more upset about the fact that they're missing their quota, or they're upset that people are dying?
Well, it must be the quota.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, if you go through 50 people and they're still worried about the sort of like making money, you know, which is actually, that's the thing that turns things around really quickly. I mean, if you've had 50 of your men die, and it is men, there's no women at all in this. And right at the end, when they come to their, you know, successful conclusion to it, it's like, you're going to make loads of money.
Yes.
I thought it was really...
it's funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, in later episodes of Trek, you know, it's kind of established that money isn't a thing. But obviously, in Series 1, it's not something that they think about. Writer was a guy called Gene Coon, who we know well, not personally, obviously, but he wrote many episodes of Star Trek, and he was the supervising producer. He was effectively the showrunner for two series, I think, or certainly one and a bit series. So, I mean, it's definitely, you know, got its good grounding in Trek stuff, and I think that it could easily have been written by someone like Robert Bloch or Richard Matheson, this story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a proper, it comes across, you know, it feels closer to a Twilight Zone story.
Yeah. It's got that sort of like pulp 50s sci-fi comic thing about it, doesn't it, really?
It doesn't have to be Star Trek. It just,
no, not at all. Not at all. And that's probably why you can get away with the teaser at the beginning, not having any references to Star Trek in there at all.
Yeah,
just something that occupies the Star Trek universe. Yes, it is a universe building episode. It's part of the first season where we start seeing the expansion of what environments they occupy.
Yeah. We get an understanding that there's an interconnectedness amongst the Federation, although I don't know whether the Federation is specifically referred to in this episode,
no,
but it's clear that there is a network going on here, and because this station powers, you know, mines per GM, I think, I forget exactly what, but there are star bases in that depending on that energy that's coming there. So we get ideas about energy supply and energy shortage still being an issue, you know, in the far future, as it is now.
Also, this world is actually inhospitable to humans anyway, because there is the crux of part of the story is that they are reliant upon the technology to keep them alive, and when the Haunter, who shows intelligence, decides to nick their regulator for their reactor, you know, then you say, "Oh yeah, this thing is actually really intelligent if it knows what to go for."
Yeah,
yeah, you know? But even then, the alarm bells aren't ringing, which is a sort of
that's right. Yeah, again, I mean, we've had this before, where it's difficult to place yourself in the mindset of the audience of the time.
Yeah,
if you're watching this episode for the first time ever, and all you've got is the previous episodes of Star Trek, with any to have any kind of knowledge or understanding of the characters, then would the time in which it took for them to reach a conclusion about this creature, would it have seemed plausible at the time? I mean, I actually remember watching this episode when I was a kid. I remember watching it as a teenager, and I watched them over and over again. But I remember the first time I ever saw it, and immediately picking up on the Spock is there and he's looking at that big thing and there's more going on here. And to what extent is this a deliberate thing by the writers to clue in the audience, or to what extent are the audience just sort of, you know, saying, well, what the hell is Spock, you know, doing here? Why is he getting preoccupied?
There is the sort of idea that you couldn't get away with this episode in later series of Star Trek, because the audience is perhaps too used to too used to Star Trek and too used to knowing what actually happens in there and how you react to intelligent life forms.
Yeah.
And for instance, if this was like a fourth season Next Gen episode, They would have cleared the miners out there already and said, well, look, this is obviously some kind of life form, indigenous life form here that we shouldn't be interfering with.
Yeah, so we need to leave.
And that would be it. That would be end of episode. But also contrast this with, say, Aliens.
Right.
Because this is what you've got, isn't it? Aliens is another way of telling this story of we're going to send down some people, we're going to kill them all. All these eggs start hatching. We're going to start.
It's good. Yeah, you've got the hideous creature, and then you've got the eggs.
Yeah,
but yeah, you just got a slightly different outcome. You don't end up breaking bread with the alien at the end of
those. You end up just wasting.
Or being wasted.
But I think this obviously it's indicative of TV of the time as well. The way they've actually used the language that people were learning from storytelling and how to convey a really good story across to the viewing public at the time, because this is the 60s still. I think that people in general have actually got more nuance on how storytelling works now. We can put more things into it.
We've seen much more telly and seen these kind of stories and seen them develop and evolve,
and there's much more experimentation. I mean, obviously the thing with this story, as you've mentioned, it's like a Twilight Zone story, but it is an improvement on it, there are so many things. It's cut down, all of the fat's been cut off, and it's gets to the story. You know, I know there is a for our audience these days, it still lingers, but you're still building up those characters. And what's really good about it as well is that we've got, we haven't mentioned McCoy comes into this as well. And you've got Kirk, McCoy and Spock, and they all have really interesting, they have an interesting relationship, but the characters are really well defined. They all got their little quirks there, Kirk is brilliant as a leader throughout this.
Yes.
You know, he makes some really good decisions, but also comes across being very affable and not arrogant, you know, the actual character. Spock is brilliant because he's still the illogical sort of stuff, but he's got that humanity is coming through, and that there's a lot of doubt there as well as being also quite clever in working out what's happening.
He reduces the body count in this episode.
Yeah.
In this scenario, he reduces the body count because he's the one who cuts through it and sees what's going on.
Yeah.
And understands at a very early stage that there's something else happening. He doesn't know what it is, but it is something else. This is not just a straightforward bug hunt. Which Kirk kind of starts off by thinking this is a bug hunt and we're going to have to do this because that's what we're here to do. But he's wise enough as a leader to listen to his first officer. Even when it gets to the point where he says, no, we're not going to save this creature. This creature is killing people. We need to get this reactor going. We need to get this thing dead. And then we need to get things back up and running again, and that's it. So when Spock tries to get the security team maybe try and injure it.
Yeah.
Kirk just shuts him down straight away and says,
yeah,
no, that's not something that you're doing. But when it comes to the actual first confrontational, second direct confrontation between Kirk and the Horta, Kirk doesn't want to kill it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think because he's a character, he's confronted with this beast and he's going, this is not as straightforward as I think
and
it is.
Spock and Spock is actually going, kill it.
Yeah, exactly.
Kirk here.
Captain, I've just read some fresh signs.
The creature is in this area. Take a life form reading.
It's not necessary, Mr. Spock. I know exactly where the creature is.
Where, Captain?
10 feet away from me.
Kill it, Captain. Quickly.
It's not making any threatening moves, Spock.
You don't dare take the chance, Captain.
Kill it.
I thought you were the one that wanted kept alive. Captured, if possible.
Jim, your life is in danger. You can't take the risk.
It seems to be waiting.
I remind you, it is a proven killer. I'm on my way. Spock out.
There is that interesting scene, though, where Spock, where Kirk and Spock have had this sort of thing Kirk tells Spock to go back and help Scotty.
Oh, I forgot about Scotty, actually.
Yeah, Scotty's down there as well. Yes. Yeah, but he's obviously busy at the time doing what Scotty does.
Yeah.
But obviously, like, there is this bit of saying, well, you know, that just doesn't make sense at all. Like, me going to help him when I'm much better served here. Yeah.
Do you think Kirk is worried that Spock's not going to be able
to do what needs to be done? Well, there seems to be lots of interplay there, doesn't there? Yeah. Lots of things going on there about how, whether levels of trust between the two of them.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's almost as if Spock is actually, is it his science that's taking him over, or is the lust of that going ahead of everything else, or is the fact that he now thinks, like, Kirk doesn't trust me anymore? So you've got lots of things in balance there.
But you also got the friendship, because what I noticed was that Spock calls Kirk Jim numerous times throughout. You know, it's like, this is my mate.
Yeah,
Jim,
moments of pressure.
Know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And sort of like, Jim, don't.
Yeah, I mean, it comes up every now and then. I mean, I've heard someone saying, "Oh, the only time Spock ever called Jim, you know, in the original series was in a mock time when he had a big emotional outburst at the end." But actually, I think he called him Jim really for as early as Where No Man Has Gone Before. It's nice to see that element of friendship between the two of them, or at least a friendship.
Very close in this episode. Mm. You know, like, at least Spock is worried about Kirk quite a lot there.
Yes.
You know.
And as you say, McCoy plays a decisive role as well.
He's such a strong period of time. He just comes along there, you know, I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer. You know,
it's a classic line, that is the first line of the "I'm a doctor, not a." Let's just talk a little bit about the creature itself, the Horta, played, if "play" is the right verb, by Janos Prochazka, who is from the Czech Republic, I think. And he it's his costume.
Yes, he designed it. He's a stuntman, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought he was a dancer as well, was he?
Well, the two are interchangeable.
I reckon you go where the work takes you.
Yeah.
If you're in the performing arts, so so he auditioned for Gene Kuhn, and Gene Kuhn loved the costume so much that he actually developed the idea for the Devil of Art as a consequence of seeing.
But wasn't it
costume.
Also that
That's
costume,
the story anyway?
The costume was also used in a Twilight Zone episode, but it was actually the prototype costume was used in a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, really?
And then they took off the head, and he used it because he refined it more,
right,
to make it more alien.
Ah, okay,
and also
that.
Faster.
Movement going,
and the faster,
the little tassels on the corners really do make that sort of.
But I think it was the last Twilight Zone episode as well.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah. So that's so it's
because
a short
this is something that Horta costume that is something that could go really badly wrong, I think.
Oh yeah.
It does look like a carpet.
It does look like a carpet, doesn't it? Yes. and I mean, I watched this episode a couple of times before recording this podcast. And although I might be looking at it, you know, through, you know, a certain filter, I still think that those scenes with the Horta work. I think they still hold up. Mm. You know, obviously, bearing in mind it, you know, the kind of show that it is and how old the show is. I don't know whether or not. What do you think of the technical aspects of
it? It still holds up now. I mean, I'm watching this. You see, the first two times I saw this show was actually in black and white. And they were and the thing is that I would say that probably I wouldn't be the only people who watched stuff like this in black and white. Because I watched it first time around in the sort of 70s, sort of like, as I said before, in the Doctor Who slot that used to be on Saturdays. Mm. So it's before you saw it. And then when they did the repeats on weekday TV around that sort of 5 to 6 o'clock slots in the after school, you know, and it was like getting home in the wintertime after school.
They started that off in peak. That run started in peak.
And then they
8 o'clock. But then they moved it to the kids' slot.
Yeah.
And they did make some cuts.
And we still had a black and white TV at the time.
Did you? Right. And so you were watching it in black and white.
And it looks really effective. That's why I always see it as being a really good episode.
Yeah.
As an alien, it really did stand out.
Yeah.
Completely different from anything else that was in Star Trek at the time. And
I think it for the in respect of the story, it's you have to be quite careful with the costume because you've got to make it so that it looks menacing but also vulnerable.
Yeah,
you have to make it show that it's actually not a threat when you look at it from another thing, and it's got to look entirely unlifelike because it is.
It's alien,
as Spock says. It's life, but not as we know it in this episode. Yeah, she uses those immortal words. And so you've got... This is what is so good about the costume, because it does get this feeling of the fact that this isn't a threat. This is like as much of a threat as a rug is.
Mm.
And that's what it looks like, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
Like
I mean,
a man hiding under a rug.
It brutally kills... The miners there.
Yeah.
So there's.
But you don't see it when it's doing that.
You don't see
it,
which is always good.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't be terribly convincing, I think, to watch it kill something. But I think that it. I mean, you get. There's a little bit of it, isn't there, when it kills the security guard, which is a nice scene, because then Kirk and Spock run in there and it's just finished off the security guard and it's making its way, and that's when they take a shot at it and manage to take a bite out of it, and then that's when they realise that it's actually made of rock. It's extraordinary. I think that it's one of the things that make it pure Star Trek for a lot of Star Trek fans is this notion of a entirely alien species. As we go on and we watch more Star Trek, we encounter more and more races that are basically bipeds but with prosthetics to make them look slightly different.
Yeah.
You don't often find too many examples of purely, genuinely alien species.
No, if they are, they're generally sort of like energy beings, aren't they? Something nice and cheap.
Something cheap. yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, and this episode allows us to really sort of like really get our heads around the idea of something that is entirely different. But of course. And the strong message is that something was an entity we can still, communicate with and understand and empathise with.
Yeah, silicon-based life form is a bit of a sci-fi staple as well, isn't it? It's something that always goes back. I did fall down a little bit down a research rabbit hole when we were doing this, because silicon-based, there are lots of things online about. Whether or not silicon-based life could actually exist, because it's in the same periodic table group as carbon, so it's the next one down. And lots of scientists saying, no, it's utterly, utterly impossible that this could actually happen. Mm. And then actually more you dig down, say, well, actually, in certain types, certain occasions, ones that do not exist naturally on Earth, you might be able, might tiny possibility be able to get this. Well, they were saying about silicon just isn't as practical as carbon, and
in our environment. Anyway.
Well, yeah, no, not in our environment. Considering the fact that silicon is almost 1,000 times more readily available than carbon is on Earth, if you could make life from silicon, that would be probably what it would be made of. But it's just so unstable and you just can't make the same things. You can't make similar hydrocarbons, which is what life is made of. You can't make those with silicon, or not readily anyway. But it does say that silicon sugars, in inverted commas, are soluble in liquid nitrogen. So maybe, just at that really, really, really cold environment, you might be able to get some kind of life.
It's funny, I was
might
actually...
exist I was, in, I was, in freezing cold pools of liquid nitrogen.
I was actually talking with a work colleague this week, this is a deviation here, about Carl Sagan's Cosmos series.
Oh yes, yeah.
And he does, in the last episode, he does a big thing about different life forms and stuff like this. And this would have been the sort of same sort of time as watching, for me, I was watching Star Trek at this sort of time, as well as watching Cosmos.
Yeah.
Because all of these ideas. I mean, they are, as you said, they have been staples of science fiction beforehand.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
You know, with the golden age of science fiction writers in America.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm sure we're going to keep coming back to.
Oh, you can rely on it. Yeah.
I mean, because it is science fiction. This is using something from science and saying, well, if something was working in a different way, this is why I think it's such a popular episode, because it's very, very science fiction.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it is half science fiction, half sci-fi, isn't it? I like the byplay between Spock and McCoy, when Spock is speculating that this is a silicon-based life form, and McCoy is not having a bar.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, but then later in the episode, when McCoy is confronted with the reality, he just completely switches and goes, right, okay, this thing obviously does exist. I'm wrong. Let's see where we go.
They all have that moment, don't they, in this episode, all three of them, when they start off in one direction and then something turns them around in one way or the other.
Yeah, and the fact that they do make that change and then still remain consistent with their characters is a testament to the actors, the characters, the direction, the writing, and just the general show. These are really well-rounded, good characters.
Mm.
Who are quite capable of acknowledging that they've made mistakes, and then going down a different path while at the same time still being consistent. A couple of points of interest that I just wanted to raise with you guys about before we talked about Spock and the Horta. The remastered version of this episode has a very, very famous and a very, very good map painting in it, which I think was used more than once in the series by Albert Whitlock, of the Janus 6 mining station, and it's the sort of almost the first thing we see when it opens. It's replaced for the remastered versions, and they incorporate a miner there who can walk around. So it looks less like a painting than the original map painting does, but to me, it still doesn't look terribly realistic anyway. So I think I would have preferred they have just kept Albert Whitlock's original piece, because it's a great painting, and I just think, well, why replace it? I mean, maybe they just thought that it just looks out of place, or maybe it didn't clean up right and it just didn't look convincing. I don't know.
Maybe in HD it didn't. Maybe it didn't survive the transfer over.
I think you're probably right, because if you look at some of the other map paintings that are used in the other episodes, this is a completely different environment anyway. And if you look at it, it doesn't look as finished, but that's because of the environment being underground, the lighting being quite different.
I think I'm with Terry here with the fact that I prefer to see it like that.
Yeah.
Because it looks like a stage set. It looks there's something very theatrical about the underground city. Always with the underground city, I'm thinking back to the discussion we had a few pods ago with What a Little Girl's Made Of.
Yeah,
that sort of tunnel environment there with the lighting.
And
the way the actors use the scenery to give the impression of like a massive drop, or the fact that they're on a precipice. And I think you've got that with the tunnels there. They don't look very convincing caves. Mind you, I do love the Horta's tunneling effect. That one scene of the two of them looking down the tunnel.
Yeah,
when you're looking at it from the other end of the tunnel. It's quite a classic image from this episode.
When Kirk is briefing his security guard and telling him there's nothing more dangerous than a wounded animal. Of course, it's still at this point they're regarding it as an animal, in that it is a beast, rather than actually probably more intelligent than they are. That effect, the tunneling effect, they also changed that as well. And I have to say, I still think that I prefer the original one, but that could really just be me, and my own enjoyment of that. This is also the episode in which William Shatner found out that his father had died, and a number of scenes had to be changed in order to accommodate his schedule. They were actually going to shut down production. but he insisted on staying and making it work, and they saw it through. Eddie Paskey, who turns up as a regular Redshirt who doesn't die, or maybe sometimes does die but then comes back to life. He's quite a well-known, plays Mr. Leslie, who is a crewman who turns up from time to time. So it's usually the same actor, a guy called Eddie Paskey. He is just a security guard in this episode, but he does body double for some rear shots for Shatner when they send Shatner home. Mm. So I think what they do is he stays, but they send him home early. Mm-hmm. The original conversation and meeting between Kirk, Spock, McCoy and Vanderbilt at the beginning of the episode was where Spock finds the silicon nodule and asks about it. That was supposed to actually happen on the Enterprise briefing room, but they elected to save time and do that. So I mean, that just adds to the narrative of the episode and why it's so well, because Shatner puts in, I think, he's brilliant in first season.
Yeah,
the scenery chewing stuff tends to happen a bit later seasons for me. I think that there are actually moments in the original series where Shatner is actually quite an understated and gives nuanced performances for Kirk.
I think
is one of them.
I think it's interesting because when I rewatched it this week, it was after I read about the fact that his father died during the production of it, and so I'm not sure whether I projected a different reading of his performance in this, because does seem
you can't help but not to
exactly, and you and so it I find it difficult now to actually think about is this actually affecting his performance, or is this because we don't know what
parts were.
No,
the part that always strikes me is when just after the security guard is dead, and Spock goes off to try and see if he can find out where the creature went to. And Kirk just kneels down by the non-existent body of his man, and he has a moment, which I think, and I always, when I was younger, I thought, well, I wonder whether or not maybe he's channeling his grief at this point in order to add to that, because it is still quite understated. But I mean, he's taking a very brief moment in the scheduling of these shows is so tight, they've got to get so much plot in. To take a moment to just acknowledge the fact that one of his crewmen has died on his watch, he's responsible for. And then he has to just get up and just get back to work again and try and find out and prevent more. And I think that that's quite an understated moment and very consistent with Kirk's character as we understand him in the years to come.
But I think you're right as well with the production schedule as it was, so squeezed together. Mm. Then this would have affected not just for this episode, but for quite a few and really for the best episodes of Star Trek. Really, of the original series, that end of first season is just
it's gold, isn't it?
Absolutely,
it's all killer no filler, isn't it? That back end of the first season.
Well, I told you about the DVD collection. Well, this is the same one. This is the same one with Errand of Mercy and City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah,
and Devil in the Dark is on this one DVD, and it's just utterly amazing.
Yeah.
So you can't escape that how good it was, but how much of that was actually coming forward. So what was obviously some quite a traumatic time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because it was sudden, apparently. I don't think anyone was there, saw it coming. Let's just talk then about the actual Spock and the Horta. And what do we think about that? I mean, you probably got something to say about the Leonard Nimoy's performance.
Well, his performance. I mean, for me, again, it sort of it defines Spock as being very different from the rest of his crews, apart from the ears and the logic and stuff like this. He's had another facet to it. But there's also the interesting thing about when there's obviously the bit when he's first communicating with the Horta, and it's like conveying the agony, sort of like, pain, all that sort of stuff.
Well, I was going to drop in a clip, but you know, I don't need to.
Well, maybe you should do that anyway. I thought that was great because obviously it's like, I think the whole episode anyway just shows there is just so many bits that are sort of, it's like if you could draw a graph of the whole of this episode, up, down for like, you know, pathos, as we were saying about like Captain Kirk and his, you know, crewmen dying, and then you go into sort of like the dramatic part of it, the friendship bit of it, the sort of like the conflict. There's everything is in this episode. You know, we forget also about the other members of the cast, the Vanderbilts, and the sort of and you did mention about the security, you know, guard and everything.
Scotty's good in this episode.
Commodore Wesley as well.
Well, he's Commodore
Wesley. Yes, indeed. Yeah, he turns up. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
So there is a lot of stuff chucked into this episode. Is this episode slightly longer than...
It might be.
I think it's over 50
minutes. I don't know, but I have a feeling it might actually be. Yeah, yeah, interestingly. You know. I think,
But what's really interesting is also it finishes on a really happy note as well. I mean, there is a nice typical sort of a McCoy and Spock, you know, sort of comedy...
Banter
bit at the end as well.
Mm. Yeah, which isn't necessarily as embarrassing as other.
No, it's actually it's pretty good, and so it actually works as a whole. This whole episode works a bit. I mean, going back to Spock's character, he does show a lot of different. You know, as an actor, he shows a lot of things with the worry, the logic, and the communication, and the.
And the sorrow as well that he has. That's what he has with the Hortus plight, and I do enjoy the final confrontation when the miners. Barge in and they're looking to kill it, and then they, you know, they lay down on them what they've done, and I think the reaction is reasonably good.
Unintentional funny lines as well in this. There was the security, the head of the red shirts.
Yeah, Commander Johto.
Yeah, when he's talking to Kirk, he's saying that sort of like I'm down here with Vandervelt, and all these workers are looking ugly.
They are actually because there's
no women down there.
There's no women down there. There is no women down there. I mean, that's the thing to probably one that it would be remiss not to point out that I mean, not even Uhura turns up in this episode. It's all blokes all the time in this episode. So I don't know quite what to make about that, but I suspect it's probably just that they felt that mining work is man's work. And there are people to this day who still say that mining work is man's work, and men, and you wouldn't find women down in a mine, even in the far future.
I thought that was very interesting because going back to recently about another science fiction show that we have actually mentioned, I was watching Humans, you know, the thing to do with like androids and stuff like that. And there is one sequence in there where they actually do have mining in South Africa. Not South Africa, I think South America. And they do have, they're using androids, but they're also using female version androids in the mines. And that really did stand out. And the point you're making now is really interesting.
I wonder whether or not probably just didn't occur to them to cast any women, is probably what it is. I don't think they were making a statement at all about it.
It's the mid 60s.
Yeah, it's the mid 60s. So obviously, all's well that ends well. The film, in a way, I suppose it is a film. The episode ends. Very happily, and we get this great sort of moment where, you know, this beast is not a beast; it's actually, you know, a lovely creature, and everyone is happy. So we learn some
horses.
And lots of little horses running around. So it works really well. I think that we can probably knock it on the head there. Does anybody else have anything that they want to get off their chest about this episode? Excellent. Okie dokie.
But it's recommended.
Well, yeah, obviously we've spoilt it for you if you haven't seen it. But we're assuming that you'll have seen it. It is very old. But there is one listener who is kind of watching along and listening to Whom Pods Destroy, so hopefully.
Cool.
He has had the chance to watch it. If he's got a brain in his head, he'll watch it. So thanks very much indeed for listening. You can visit our website, Whom Pods Destroy, and that has all of our contact details. If you have a mind to sharing this podcast with your friends or your networks, then by all means do. That would be lovely because obviously, you know, it's nice to have people and more people listening to the show. We will be back next time where we'll be talking about Star Trek for the Voyage Home. That's quite a good thing, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Well, I think this is really interesting because it does connect very similar. It's a very similar
themes.
To actually Devil in the Dark, you know, and I'm very interested in this one.
What about you, Graham? How do you feel about doing Star Trek?
I don't understand the question.
I feel fine. Lovely. Okay, we'll end it there. Thanks very much again. See you next time. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Devil in the Dark, I thought was a wonderful episode about the fear of the unknown, how we fear and even hate something that we don't know anything about. Learn who your enemy is, and maybe then it's not no longer your enemy. Interesting episode.